as I wait, heart of God.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Growth Group podcast, where we believe that spiritual growth happens better in circles than it does in rows. My name is David Haken, and I'm joined by Jonathan Markham, the pastor of New Life Christian Fellowship here in Pacifica, California, and we record these podcasts to help you get the most out of your small group discussion each week. This week, we're continuing our series about doubt, looking at different characters in the Bible, different character studies of Bible characters who have experienced some form of doubt in their lives. And it's interesting. We're moving on to John the Baptist having just studied Elijah. That's a fun little comparison back to back, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because of course
there's a relationship there.
Yeah, there is. Of course, Malachi gives us that Elijah will come, and then Jesus says,
yeah.
Of course, we know that Elijah has already come. Mm-hmm. And of course, mm-hmm. he means John the Baptist. So
It
really is remarkable. I think so, David. I don't know about you, but you know, there are very few characters in Scripture who you cannot see as having had some form of doubt, who've moved through their lives in a with a form of perfect belief.
It's like,
even Jesus.
It's like Daniel and Joseph. Those are like the only two, maybe, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
Joseph was so emotional.
Yes.
So it's kind of.
I mean, and Joseph had. Joseph, I mean, I'm sure that Joseph thought God had forgotten him when he was in prison. And the two, the baker and the candlestick.
I'd have to go back and look at those latter chapters of Genesis.
I feel sure.
See if we have any emotional hints there. Because it does seem to resolve every one of those letdowns is, but God was still with him.
Yes.
But God was still with him.
Yes. God, but, you know, I it's reasonable.
He had every
Daniel,
reason
I think,
to.
I think, Daniel, you're right. There are no clear places where Daniel seems to doubt. you wonder whether he, with what trepidation he went into the lion's den. But
right. And there is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and like, why isn't Daniel in there? But
right.
Who knows? Maybe he's off doing official business.
And of course, they said, even if he kills us, we're okay.
Right. Amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Elijah didn't have that confidence at one point
last
week.
No, he didn't. Yeah, he did not.
So this week we are again going to do our close reading question, a question which asks us to find a light bulb, a question mark, and an arrow from within our passage. It's especially appropriate as we're just looking at kind of the first half of Matthew 11 and really kind of digging into John the Baptist's emotional space as he's there in prison and his disciples have come carrying a message from him to Jesus. So I think there's some really good parallels to be found in there, good connections, good personal applications. So I think this one will work well. How has the close reading question gone for your group, Jonathan?
Well, we
haven't quite met yet this week.
No, we haven't. Last week we had a number of people who were away, so we didn't. It wasn't quite so.
Okay. Yeah, it's
Because we hadn't had yes, that's right.
It's been a little while.
We haven't done the we haven't met yet because we're going to meet tomorrow to do our first of our return to the close reading question.
Well, we're confusing you with our timeline and chronology, I'm sure. So I'll apologize for that and move on to our second question. John the Baptist questions, or JB's question. Sometimes there lies unspoken questions beneath our spoken ones. After John the Baptist's thrilling early ministry, he finds himself in prison, asking Jesus, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" What questions are behind this question? How does John the Baptist's question resemble Job's? And what questions do you have for God, things you don't understand why he hasn't fixed yet?
Well, it's interesting here. I think some of the clues that we get. I mean, there are various interpretations to this question. I mean, some people think that he's asking the question on behalf of his disciples, and questions like I'm afraid I don't That's not what I think Jesus replies to. Jesus replies to John directly, and I think therefore that John's asking the question for himself.
He says, "Send the message back to John, your master."
I think the clues that we find are earlier in Matthew, when John is just before John baptizes.
Chapter three, just before
he baptizes.
So 11 and 12.
When you read the John's preaching. Mm-hmm. And you see, right the way through is to 11 and 12, and you see that the emphasis of John's preaching was on justice and judgment.
Repentance and judgment.
And judgment. And yet Jesus' ministry has been focused on compassion and healing and all of those things.
Yeah, up to this point. He hasn't had a lot of interaction with the Pharisees yet.
Yeah, up to now, that's what he's been doing. And so I think that is where John is saying, look, the message I was given you don't seem to be doing what I thought you were going to do.
Right.
It underlines the thing that I think is so, creates so many doubts in our Christian lives, is our expectations. We have expectations of how God will, a God would behave. We have expectations about what Jesus would do, given his context. And time again, God confounds what we think he should do, and Jesus confounds what we think he should do. And so I think John has got some slightly skewed expectations of what he I think he's... which comes into the next question. There's things he's forgotten, and there's things he's assumed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our kind of conversation here, and as far as John's expectations, gives us interesting perspective on, I think, certainly a verse that has had different interpretations, where it says that I baptize you with water, but the one who is coming after me will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and with fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our minds automatically go to Pentecost when we think of flaming tongues. But the very next verse, he says that the winnowing fork is in his hand and he will clear the threshing floor, but the chaff you will burn with unquenchable fire. So perhaps that there's some kind of judgment in this baptism with fire.
And it's really interesting because, of course, we don't know where John got his message from. We know so little about
we assume it's a valid one, though.
I mean, because if it wasn't a valid one, I mean, Jesus says some pretty remarkable things about John in the rest of Matthew chapter 11, where he says, I tell you the truth in verse 11, of all who have ever lived, none is greater than John the Baptist.
Yeah.
That is a pretty remarkable endorsement.
And elsewhere, I want to find it now. Elsewhere, it explicitly says that John did not come with signs. He didn't perform signs. And yet there are so many who preceded him that had mighty and great signs. And yet Jesus still, there you go. John 10:41 has that description. Really briefly before we move on to our third question, 10:41.
We're still here.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Excuse me. It was the wrong verse. It's not 10:41. So forget about it. You'll have to Google that one later yourselves to track that one down. But Let's look at Jesus' response to John's question. John, of course, asks, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Jesus' response is what we're going to look at in this next question. Well, it is very true that Jesus did not fulfill all of the Old Testament expectations of the Messiah in his first coming. Jesus invited John to examine those Old Testament expectations he did fulfill. Compare Isaiah 29, 35, and 61 with what you know about the early ministry of Jesus. While Matthew 11:6 might be understood as a mild rebuke, on the whole, was Jesus harsh with John in his response, or was he gentle? Take a look at Matthew 11:29. Have you ever been afraid of or suppressed your questions about the faith? How does this story teach us to act otherwise?
In my opinion, Jesus was it was very compassionate and gentle with John. Mm-hmm. And I think that that reflects the way we've seen God handle people who've had doubts before. I think that Jesus is very well aware that John is in jail, which may not be what he had, which I'm sure was not what he anticipated. John anticipated being part of it. I mean, one doesn't know what John anticipated being his role after Jesus had begun his ministry. Because the interesting thing is that it seems that when John was arrested...
I must be lesser, you must be greater. Yes.
But did he anticipate the fact that he was going to have no part in Jesus' ministry? Or I don't know. But clearly, or I assume, he didn't anticipate that he was going to be thrown in jail almost before Jesus' ministry started. Mm-hmm. And so all he knows about what Jesus is doing is... what his disciples, he kept in touch with his disciples. He was in this jail right on the top of a big hill. And clearly his disciples kept in touch with him. And he was saying that and the guys were clearly telling him what Jesus was doing. And we get a clue.
He had every reason to want to know what Jesus was doing with the way that he...
And we get a clue a little bit earlier in Matthew. We get a clue that that he was asking some questions, because he asks the question, I haven't got the reference right now, but the disciples come to him a little bit earlier and say,
9:14.
You know, they say, you were supposed to be, why aren't you doing one day the disciples, this 9:14, one day the disciples of John the Baptist came and asked him, why don't your disciples fast like we do and the Pharisees do? So there was obviously some questions that John was continuing to ask.
We don't know if that's just the disciples of John or John himself in this case, but there's certainly a discrepancy between the behavior of the disciples of John and the behavior of the disciples of Jesus.
And I think it's reasonable to suspect that since a little bit later on we see John asking that there's a group of them there's only two. Luke tells us there's two of them, but there were people with John and their discussions about Jesus's ministry, which seems quite reasonable. And so he's telling them, if you read through Matthew 8 and 9, there's all these things that Jesus did. They don't really line up with what the message that John preached that Jesus was going to do.
Right.
And so his questions are, you know, he in a sense, I don't know whether the message of that John gave in Matthew 3 was what had, whether he missed any pieces out that he'd hoped Jesus would do, but clearly he believes that and probably hoped that Jesus would do the things that the judgment and all of that stuff. But Jesus does something completely different, and John, as a good one assumes, a good Jewish boy who's read the scriptures, Jesus is pointing out to him, the same age as Jesus. You want to assumes that Jesus is simply pointing out, you know what Isaiah said, you've just forgotten that he said, these are the things that the Messiah is going to do. Those verses we've given you in Isaiah make it quite clear that the things that if you look at the verses in Isaiah.
Yeah, I think those verses talk about the kind of things that will be true in the Messianic age. It will be true that the deaf will hear. It will be true that the blind will see. But what John is doing is he's saying there are a whole lot of other things about the Messianic age that aren't true. The fact that you're not ruling as king is kind of paramount.
That you're not doing some of these things.
Right.
And if you look at the parallels between the verses in Isaiah and then Matthew 8 and 9, you see that the part of the vision is being unfolding, but Jesus is saying, you know, you don't ignore this.
I think some of the biggest questions that the New Testament has to answer are questions that we don't necessarily ask, but were on, you know, everyone's lips back then is, why is there two comings of Christ, a first coming and a second coming? That was extremely veiled, if not even present in the Old Testament, that there being two different things. And then the inclusion of the Gentiles and just what that would look like. I think that's encapsulated in the mystery passage in Ephesians 2. Those things are, they need explaining.
Right. And it's interesting because I have a friend who's Jewish who I meet in the gym regularly. And he said to me one day with great, just as a throwaway line, well, he said, I don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. He didn't fulfill what the rabbis said he was going to do. I have yet to ask him what it is that he didn't fulfill. But
he would probably have lots of things to say. Yeah, I mean, the verses surrounding these verses that we've given you in 29, 35, and 61, lots there. It's part of the will of God.
Right, and they assume because he didn't do all of those things that he wasn't who he said he was.
Well, here comes the millennium, and then we'll get the rest. Yeah. That's, we don't need to open that can of worms. So our last question we will open up, though. It's called a rejection of JB and Jesus. Like Job, when we are suffering and in doubt, it can be tremendously helpful to see ourselves in the larger story. John the Baptist needed this clarity in Matthew 11. In the larger context of Matthew, Jesus had just revealed himself to Israel by word, Matthew 5 to 7, by deed, Matthew 8 and 9, and by the proclamation of his disciples in Matthew 10. Now, in Matthew 11 and 12, it records Israel's response to Jesus, which is sadly rejection. How does Matthew 11, specifically 16 through 19, begin to describe John's participation in this rejection? Where have you benefited from seeing yourself in the larger story? Where might you need your perspective lifted even now?
Well, it seems that John's question about the things that Jesus wasn't doing begins the pattern, in a sense, for the things that Israel as a whole believed that he should do and he wasn't doing. And we see this, this pattern of all, when, you know, as the rejection proceeds, it's based on, you know, you're not doing the things that the Messiah is supposed to do.
Right, right.
And so you can't be the Messiah. And so the in a sense, the people of Israel don't buy the answer Jesus gives and reject him.
Yeah, and we kind of see that even in verse 12 as well. And there's a lot of different translations. I think the NLT goes a little bit different direction than kind of the majority of the translations. But from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has advanced strongly or something like that?
It's been forcefully advancing, and violent people are attacking it.
Yeah, but as far as the kingdom being attacked violently, we certainly see that in John's arrest and certainly what's going to happen with Jesus in the end of the Gospels. But so here we have John's quote-unquote rejection. Now he's arrested by Herod, Antipas, who is kind of like a Jewish king, but there's probably very few Jews who actually supported Herod. So that's a little bit ambiguous, but but Matthew seems to open up the blame for John's rejection a little bit more widely in 18, where it speaks of John saying that he came neither eating nor drinking. You know, he was in the wilderness with sackcloth and eating locusts with honey. And they said, he has a demon. So who is the they in this case? It seems to be more broadly than perhaps just the religious leadership. Although he did spark a large revival and he did accomplish his mission to prepare the way, at least for the hearts of a remnant of Israel.
And it's fascinating that all of those people went out there and repented. And I mean,
Right.
Yeah. Amazing.
inspired to do so by God himself. But we might hear more about that on Sunday, or perhaps you already have. Mm. With that, I think we'll wrap it up for this podcast and look forward to our next podcast, the fifth of six in this series.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, excellent. Another New Testament one, and
another
we'll
find out
who he is next week. Looking forward to seeing you.
As I wait.